Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is +972, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. Hope you're doing well on what started out as quite a nice morning this morning and then got a smidgen on the cold side. So hope that you are having a great start to your week in what is officially feeling more and more and more like winter, although technically I suppose it is still autumn. The trees are looking beautiful. I'm loving looking at all the trees as you drive around Johannesburg, which is great. And I have to say, I almost didn't make it to the show today because Michael McKenna was talking about making nice wintry food, which, you know, seemed like quite a good idea at the time. So, yeah, that is what is convening on our week. But what is convening on our show today? What are we going to be talking about? Well, a bit of a hodgepodge today, but a lot of it very, very Israel-related, just happens to be where we are just right at the moment. So what are we going to be talking about? Well, a few things. The one is we're going to be talking about animal conspiracy theories related to Zionists in Israel and what that has to do with the New York Times. We're going to be talking about Eurovision. I'm not typically a Eurovision fan, but these are things we have to talk about. We're going to be finding out about what Zohra Mamdani can teach us about the early origins of the state of Israel. And we are also going to be finding out about coal exports in South Africa and why they matter in general. And we're going to be looking also at an unusual Iranian travelogue, which gives us an insight into the world of the Middle East in the 1960s. So that is all coming up on the show for today. And of course, we like to have your engagement as well to be part of the fun. So if you would like to give us your perspectives, please do so at your time and choosing, but preferably whilst I'm on air, because otherwise I won't be able to read them. But if you would like to, 061-895-1019, that is our WhatsApp line, 061-895-1019. And we will be able to have a chat to you and get your perspective about what is going on. And indeed, we do want to hear from you because Chai FM is updating our Voices of Chai, and we need your voice to do it. Send us a voice note, 30 seconds or less, and tell us why you're part of the Chai FM community. What keeps you listening? What does the station mean to you? Send your voice note to 061-895-1019. That's 061-895-1019. 1019. We cannot wait to hear from you. Coming up after the break, your entire short history of Zionist animal conspiracies here on 101.9 Chai FM.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and there's been quite a lot of discussion. I'm pretty sure that Howard's covered it. If he hasn't, Simon definitely hasn't. If the both of them haven't, we'll discover it now. But really, around the world, there's been a lot of condemnation in the last week about an article written in the New York Times by a guy called Bill Kristol, who is a kind of columnist there. And he wrote this thing about the sexual assault of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. And what's very quickly happened is that people looking at these allegations have found that, in fact, the sources that he used came from dubious sources, that he didn't do proper background checks. The one source was something called Euromed, which is basically a Hamas-connected group who has in the past accused Israel of vaporizing Palestinians using a new weapon. The reason that they made this claim was because there was suddenly a discrepancy in the Gaza Health Ministry's numbers on how many Palestinians had died, and Israel was in Gaza to harvest organs, all this kind of stuff. So there are a lot of problems with this thing, and basically, unfortunately, takes what should be a very serious issue, which is abuse in prisons, which happens around the world, including in Israel, and has been the subject of some Israeli reporting, and turns it into some vast kind of conspiracy theory without any background or proper checks. And what's interesting is that although the New York Times sometimes is not really a very effective, they have lots of fact checkers or whatever, they make mistakes, right, in their newsroom. And sometimes those are ideological mistakes in terms of how they write things. So, for example, during the early part of the war, the Al Ali Hospital was hit by a Palestinian rocket, and a number of people were killed, and the number of 500 was given out, and Israel was blamed for that. So that and the New York Times, along with BBC and a lot of others, actually faithfully reported that. So the news on the New York Times can be quite dodgy. And we've seen it, and we'll talk about Eurovision a little bit later on, but they basically tried to sort of undermine Israel's whatever their campaign on Eurovision, but as you'll hear, it didn't work. So they can do that sort of thing, but the thing is, it's the problem really is that. The problem with it is that it's not the news, it's the op-ed section. So I just got trying to figure out my train of thought there. Yeah, it's not the news, but it's actually the op-ed section. So what by putting it in the op-ed section, basically they can get away with even the fact checking that the New York Times sometimes does. They actually don't have to make use of it, basically. And so that's why this guy was able to put these ridiculous things across using the op-ed section. But that is not what I want to talk about, because that's the general article and I needed to give you some context. But what I really wanted to say and engage with was the question of one of the allegations which is made, is that dogs were somehow used in the involvement in this set of allegations, and that some other dogs were involved in these acts against the Palestinian prisoners, which is ridiculous, honestly, and a little bit absurd. But what's interesting is that it's actually not new. There's a whole Wikipedia article out there, which one can go and see if one wants to, about the history of animal-related Zionist conspiracies. And so I thought I would actually just go through some of them with you, just to see how it is that animals come to be part of these sorts of things. Mostly animals are accused or arrested or detained for being Israeli spies. So, for example, let's see some of these. In 2011, a Lebanese newspaper published a column looking at animal-related conspiracy theories, and a number of them involve birds. So the thing about birds is they often have, you know, pins or rings on their feet, and so as a result, people always think that these are tracking devices. So in 2013, a kestrel carrying an Israeli footband was discovered in a province in Turkey, and it was immediately identified by personnel at the university as being an Israeli spy, and no charges were filed, and the kestrel was freed. So they tried to arrest the kestrel. Then in 2012, a dead European bee eater with an Israeli leg band, which is used to track birds, was also found in Germany, and the villagers worried that a microchip from Israeli intelligence was being carried, and the poor head of agricultural and livestock had to actually be brought out to actually look at this thing, and also a counterterrorism unit, but apparently they told them that this wasn't such a big deal. In 2012, a Sudanese newspaper had reported that the government had captured a vulture, which was said to be an Israeli spy because of Hebrew and electronic devices. It turns out that the young vulture was tagged along with 100 others with a German-made GPS and apparently it didn't have any actual abilities to look at anyone or see anything. The zoologist said, "What is the benefit of watching a vulture eat the insides of a dead camel?" Which I suppose is wisdom we can all live by. In 2013, Hezbollah claimed that an Israeli spying eagle had been captured in Lebanon. Apparently, this was also a hapless eagle that was as part of a program. And an rare eagle from the Golan Heights was actually captured by Syrian opposition forces and first suspected of being an electronic espionage bird. But then apparently, he, in good luck for the eagle, was actually returned to Israel as a gesture of recognition for the medical treatment that Israel had provided to Syrians during the Syrian civil war. So that is another problem. Getting off the birds, because there's actually quite a lot. There's another one out of a griffon vulture. But it's not just birds, you understand. It's fish as well. In 2010, several shark attacks occurred in the southern Sinai resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. And following these attacks, a Egyptian television show said that a GPS device found on one of the sharks was acting as a guiding agent planted by Israeli agents. And the foreign ministry has suggested that perhaps the Egyptians might have been watching a few too many Jaws. There was, you know, there were a number of other issues to do with sharks. Interestingly, the Israelis do, of course, use animals. Animals have been used by armies for centuries in different ways. So mules and camels are used to move things, and llamas have been used to hide soldiers from heat-seeking devices. Anti-tank dogs were used in an attack against the PLO at one stage. And antelope and oryxes have been introduced to Israeli army bases to clear vegetation, while Barbary sheep are used to guard ammunition depots. Now, this, I have to say, I haven't seen any other proof of, but it's interesting why a Barbary sheep would be used in an ammunition depot. But among mammals, a range of conspiracy theories have included Zionist pigs, and that's not a term of abuse. It's actual pigs, swines, wild boars that have been accused of this, hyenas, rotists, and an unlucky dolphin. When an Al-Qassam brigade Hamas claimed that they had captured a dolphin wearing a camera off the coast of Gaza. So, and also rats, and cattle, and a number of reptiles. I can't go through them all. There's just so much. The point I want to make is that what you'll notice about these conspiracy theories is that they all are part of the Arab world, the fever swamps of crazy anti-Zionists who literally can see a Mossad agent under every bush. And okay, that's the world we live in, and everything is, that's, you got to just deal with that. But at the end of the day, you don't expect that this sort of nonsense is going to be written up in the New York Times, which is the paper of record of the world. And so besides the horrific allegations that Bill Kristol has made, I think this tells us something about where the zeitgeist of the newspaper is going. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 Chai FM.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
And I'm Benji Shulman, and I'm part of your day every Monday between 12 and 3 on the 972 show, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. And we were just talking about the problem of Zionist conspiracy theories involving animals. If you have any comments, by the way, 061-895-1019. If you've ever caught an Israeli spy parrot in your bathroom, I want to hear about it and I want to know about it. And by the way, what really irritates me is that what really the New York Times should have been reporting on was the enormous claims which have been documented now in a major study and put together dealing with the atrocities of October 7th. And it seems that this thing was put in to the New York Times as a way of deflecting that. And so they have gone after the they've basically gone after the victims once again instead of centering them. But anyway, let us move on to another topic, though it is sort of still sticking with the New York Times for some reason, sort of not. And, well, let's start there. Basically, the New York Times published another article, this time talking about how basically accusing Israel of duping the system when it came to Eurovision. Of course, Eurovision, if you don't know it, it's this big pan-European plus Australia and Azerbaijan and Israel and a few others, basically people who use European TV stations effectively. And they have this big song-off contest where different countries put different acts together. It's often quite ridiculous. It's quite camp. It's supposed to be a lot of fun. But in the last few years, Eurovision has become a bit of a political contestation. It's always been quite a political place because the voting comes from people, first from juries in different countries and then from populations. And you're not allowed to vote for your own country. And so people tend to vote for other countries that they like or want to support in different ways. And this has been very normal. After Russia invaded Ukraine, the Eurovision decided to throw them out because it, I guess, was one Eurovision country invading another. But because of this, there's now been calls to ban Israel as well. And a number of countries actually refused to participate and even actually wouldn't even show the actual contest in their countries this year. So they included Spain, which is and Slovenia, both of which have quite left-wing governments. The outstanding one is the Netherlands, which is kind of interesting. It's not a, you know, it's a fairly right, it has a fairly conservative government, and they're also in part of this boycott. I think Iceland as well. And some of them have played things other than Eurovision. The poor viewers, I think in Slovenia, were treated to, instead of watching Eurovision, they were treated to like the history of nomadic peoples in Norway, I think, but like presented by someone who had once won the Eurovision. I mean, I think I'd rather poke my eyes out and eat them than actually watch that. But, you know, this is what's happening to these poor populations whose sort of public broadcasters don't want to be involved. And it's been a big issue in Eurovision, but to their credit, they sort of held the line. But basically the main allegation by the New York Times is that the government sort of got involved to promote this thing because it's a kind of soft power and is a place where Israel can show that it is up on the world stage. And I don't think that this is unusual. It actually is something that happens fairly often, is that countries try and promote themselves. And if you read the article, like they accuse them of like an Israeli ambassador going to a local diaspora community or Christians and saying, please vote for Israel. So, and then this is somehow considered somehow malevolent. It's a little bit absurd. Anyway, the point about it is that ever since October 7th, and ever since this boycott sort of began, Israel has been doing quite well in the Eurovision. There was Hurricane by Edon Galan, which came out quite well. There were a number of others, and Israel won the Eurovision, I think, in 2018 with Toy, and pretty much then has been having quite a good run. And last year they came second. And what was interesting about that was that the jury vote in the different countries, in other words, the people who were voting for Israel in the countries who were like, normally these are like people who are supposedly know something about the arts and whatever, they gave Israel a fairly low score on last year's song, which I now cannot remember. Howard will, I'm sure, know what it is. You can ask him. But it basically was given quite a low score by the jury votes, but the people who were voting in the populations gave it quite a high vote. And instead of, and this was like quite a big slap in the face, especially because these votes were coming from inside countries where there were high levels of anti-Israel kind of pressure. And so like the, I guess, the Arabs who see, you know, Zionist chalks all over the place. Instead, what these Europeans now said is, oh no, the Israelis must be cheating, and we want them thrown out. And so this caused a big hullabaloo, and everyone got all excited, and they tried to throw Israel out. And then in the end, with the ceasefire, there was no decision taken to throw Israel out. Instead, they said, no, we're going to adjust the voting mechanism and make sure that it isn't used to inappropriately vote for people that basically don't deserve it. So that was all well and good, and now we came back to this year's Eurovision, and everyone was doing some interesting stuff. And the winner was actually a Bulgarian group, which actually I thought did quite a good job. I mean, in my sort of wildly expansive knowledge of what it means to win a Eurovision, but it seemed like quite a good Eurovision song. It was a bit strange, a little bit wacky, catchy. It had like a funny title that you could like engage with. It was a very kind of thing that you could like watch with Eurovision. So I think that the Bulgarians was sort of like rightly deserved. But who came up number second? But Israel once again. And this time with Norm Batan of this thing, Michelle, half of it was in French. Some of it was in Hebrew, but it was in English. And they came in second. And what's interesting here is that the jury vote here actually had improved quite, I think, six places. If I'm stand to be mistaken, to be corrected. But I think last year it was 14 out of 25, so nearly sort of halfway down the pack. And this year Israel was voted in by the juries to number eight. And when the public vote came in, that once again pushed them up to second place. So having duped the system, or rather said that the system is the problem from a voting perspective, and then changed it supposedly so that Israel wouldn't win. Israel won anyway in terms of coming second. I think it's probably better, to be perfectly honest, that they came second and not first, because then there would have been more calls for boycotts or whatever. But effectively, the Israelis showed that there is support again on the continent for this kind of stuff. It's a good, people do support Israel. I think that European society, this is a signal that they don't really like what has been going on with their government stance, and they're annoyed with some of their own internal problems. But I also think that the Israelis are actually just good at getting a proper act to put together something. The choreography is good. It's like, as it turns out, meritocracy is a defense against boycott, because if you provide a good product, then normal people will just want to make use of it in one way or another. Highlight, for example, with the British one, which was awful. I mean, it was a decent British song. If you wanted some British grunge punk rock, then you'd do fine. It doesn't work for Eurovision, and anyone could see that, even me. And they indeed came last, and they came, I think, to be fair on them, they did 100 times better than they did last year, because this year they got 1 point and last year they got zero. So that's like 100% improvement if you're British. But they're just not providing the goods, and as a result, they don't get anywhere. Whereas the Israelis have actually figured out that if you put some attention, they've got good performers, and then they can do well in these sorts of competitions. And it annoys the sort of pink-haired social justice warriors, because they think that everyone agrees with them or should agree with them. And so when they don't see a boycott happening, then this causes a bunch of consternation. That is my view. But what's interesting is that the jury system, the people who are also most at risk here, because if they vote in the wrong way with Israel, then they, you know, they can get ripped on social media and their careers get ended or whatever. They clearly were more comfortable now starting to normalize Israel's participation and actually take a proper view that wasn't political. Interesting, the polls, of all people, decided, gave the most points to Israel in their awarding of different elements. So that I thought was actually quite interesting as well. The other thing which is fascinating in Eurovision, this, it doesn't have anything to do with Jews or Israel, but I think it's important because we understand how media is consumed, right? So about 15 years ago, there was a Moldovan group called the Sunstroke Project. You can go look them up, the Sunstroke Project. And they did the song, which basically didn't go anywhere. It got into the finals. It was a Eurovision song. They played it and people left. But the of the whole band, the saxophonist was like really, really kind of giving it his all and quite funny and he played like a very good riff. And this riff then sort of became famous on TikTok because it was something that people could add to videos. And he kind of became a bit of a meme. Like people always, you know, were watching this guy, and it was like always funny. And he'd get, you know, he survived the fact that his song and his band didn't go anywhere in Eurovision. And from what I can tell, the rest of the band has not done really anything else with their lives since they were on Eurovision. But still, you know. So he sort of maintained a kind of a cult following on the internet. And as a result, a guy called KSI, who was a British YouTuber who made like weird FIFA videos and commentaries on soccer and, you know, these sorts of things, he decided that he was going to do this band thing, the saxophonist thing. I'll see if I can get Craig to pull it up for you and we can play it maybe as the show goes out. Just so you can hear what it sounds like. But basically, he then dressed up as in like gold suited pants and walked around Britain playing this riff off of his saxophone. And whatever, people love that because they love this guy and he's become quite famous and it's very nice. Now, this guy, KSI, has now been, for the last couple of years, put onto the judging panel in Britain's Got Talent. I think that they realized that people like Simon Cowell and the other people, Amanda, are not classical TV people, and KSI doesn't come from that world at all. He is a YouTuber and has a different aesthetic, and so they brought him in to have a look. He's got quite a good personality. He's fun to watch. And now what happened as a thing, and I don't know how scripted this is. I hope it wasn't completely scripted. But this guy from the Sunstroke Project arrived one day and actually redid his thing on Britain's Got Talent and then showed the video of KSI in his thing doing his thing and put it together in like a video dancing. And KSI thought this was completely hilarious. And now for the semifinals, they actually got through to the semifinals because on the basis of this, they actually performed together in this thing. And you can go look it up, Epic Sax Guy and KSI on the internet. And it was a very interesting thing watching in the comments how there's like a bifurcation in the world between probably the older audience who watches Britain's Got Talent and a younger audience who might have been watching funny memes on TikTok and had picked up the Epic Sax Guy thing. Because when the Epic Sax Guy originally played, KSI was like, oh, wow, this is amazing. So cool. And none of the judges had ever actually seen him. And so what's interesting about this, I'm a wildly ignorant person when it comes to pop culture, but you can see the two worlds kind of colliding together, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, but in this case successfully, where you have someone who's a kind of a star on the internet but doesn't really have mainstream engagement being connected to the classic sort of TV format and the two sort of cultural ideas working with one another. And I think that's interesting because I think it probably is happening here as well. You know, the way that people watch, say, SABC or ETV or listen to a station like ours and some people on Instagram and Twitter and whatever is all very, very interesting about how that will work and how messages are spread, right? If you want a negative way to think about this, because let's not be too happy about things on a Monday afternoon, you can look at someone like Hassan Piker, who's a virulently anti-Semitic a Twitch player, right? So Twitch is it's like a gaming platform where you can also do commentary. I risk sounding like an idiot because I don't think I've used all that much Twitch in my life, but I can see that Howard's daughter's here, so maybe she can help and explain what in the world Twitch is. But the point is that Hassan built an audience out of Twitch and then was able to leverage that into political commentary and now into political influence. And so you have actual Democratic politicians who are desperate to find an alternative to someone like Tucker Carlson, who is also someone who went from the mainstream media and is now kind of running his own podcast, that they don't have an equivalent of that on the left. And so Hassan, who's wildly anti-Semitic, but nonetheless popular and supposedly good-looking, is now suddenly getting rave reviews, again, by the New York Times and the New Yorker and these sorts of legacy media to try and up their cool factor. And as a result, you have these sort of changeover. And I think that, to be honest, Jews who tend to communicate in old style, they like newspaper columns and short form interviews and basically traditional media. If the real horrendous anti-Semitism is being spread at the moment, thanks to the Chinese Communist Party on TikTok, right? And so we're going to have to find a plan to combat that, because the old style of doing things ain't going to be working forever. Now, I'm not saying that the legacy media is unimportant. It can be quite important to fact check things and give legitimacy to certain stories. But the fact is that in terms of driving truths and half truths and whatever, you can hear some garbage coming out of the New York Times, but it can equally be something which can come out of your child's TikTok. And I think that that's part of why we've seen a fallback in perceptions of Israel amongst younger people. Let me know what you think. Tell me if you saw the Eurovision or if you have a viewpoint on this. 061-895-1019. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is Plus 972. We'll be back just after this.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
You're listening to 101.9 Hi FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is 972, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. And so that was a long discussion about Eurovision. And if you have a view on it, send us a WhatsApp, 061-895-1019, and we will certainly have a look at it. Now, staying in New York, we seem to be very New York centric today on the show. I don't quite know why, but it is what it is. We're going to talk about Zoran Mamdani, who is the Democratic Socialist, not big fan of Israel, problematic person who is the mayor of New York. And just in case anyone wasn't sure that he was going to be sticking by this theme, he made it by tweeting something yesterday, which was, last week, on Yom Yerushalayim, Jerusalem Day, because he claimed that that day was it was sort of the English date, I think, of the War of Independence, which anti-Israel groups like to refer to as the Nakba, and they talk about the Palestinians that fled during that period. And what was interesting is that he managed to dig up somebody who had been part of the fighting themselves or was a descendant of this person, and said, look here, you know, this is a Palestinian who was forced from their home during the 1948 war, which of course is garbage. There were incidences, of course, where people were forced from their homes, but a lot of Palestinian Arabs just left on their own accord, or because they wanted to escape the fighting, or because they were listening to messages from various Arab media and the implicit messages coming from the leadership. But what was really interesting about this particular person is that it turns out that she sort of undermines some of the key claims of the Palestinian National Movement, because she comes from a community in the Balkans who came to Israel in the sort of late 1800s, early 1900s, really around the same time as some of the European Jews that settled there came as well. Now, the claim from Palestinians and even from non-Palestinians is that, well, you know, the Canaanites were there before the Israelites. I've actually saw this on Facebook by someone like a public figure in the media. And so, you know, the Israelites were the original invaders of the homeland. Now, I don't know about you, but I haven't seen a Canaanite walking around recently at all. There's very little to suggest that Palestinians have anything to do with Canaanite culture, DNA, history, or otherwise. And so, you know, there's this idea that the Palestinians were there for since time immemorial. But this woman, her family would have literally come there in the 19th century at the same time as some of the European Jews. And so he sort of undermines the whole case of what Palestinian national identity actually is. And you can see it, by the way. I've had this experience where you have like a panel where you have an Israeli, you have a Palestinian, or maybe just an Israeli Arab, and you'll have somebody else, and they're talking about peace and engagement. And I've had South African groups visit these sorts of panels and then direct their questions after the panel is done to the Palestinian on the basis that they are more, shall we say, white looking than the Israeli. And then they have to be like corrected. And for them, this is very confusing that the Israeli is darker in skin tone than the Palestinian. And the reason for that is because the Palestinian population has a lot of Europeans who came and were part of that community. And so their genetics is passed down. And as a result, many Arabs look basically like white people, effectively. And it's kind of confusing for people because of the way that this thing works at a paradigm level, and it's kind of fascinating for people to actually learn that and understand it. And interestingly, all you needed to be considered a Palestinian refugee is be the descendant, not actually be a person, but to be the descendant of someone who was in sort of the mandate period during the war for 2 years. You only had to live there for 2 years. So in other words, if someone had arrived for work, which was quite common in that time, you lived there and then you left during the war, you and your entire family would be considered refugees to this day. And it's kind of a fascinating discussion about how people see these sorts of things and how they actually work. So I just thought we'd thank Zoram Mamdani for assisting us in that understanding of Palestinian identity. Thank you, Zoram. Moving on to something else, which is it's kind of connected, but moving away from New York, we have a situation at the moment where there's been a campaign to try and get rid of South African coal going to Israel. Now, South African coal makes up a considerable part of our exports to Israel. There's still a significant amount of trade that happens between the two countries, but coal is an important part of it because it goes to Israeli power stations in different guises. And then there's been a campaign for the last sort of year or year and a half to try and stop this coal from going. And what was kind of interesting is that the Colombian government, which is on a similar kind of political track to South Africa and has worked with them on this thing called the Hague Group, which is a international group which is trying to enforce sanctions. The Colombians actually believe what they say when they talk about boycotting Israel, because Colombia and South Africa both provide the most amount of coal to Israel. And so when all of this started, the Colombians got on board and then cut their coal supplies. But the South Africans didn't. And basically, you had this situation in which our coal exports then promptly tripled because now the Israelis needed more coal, the Colombians weren't selling it, and South Africans were. And so now there's been a campaign to try and restrict the coal. I think that this has also got to potentially do with upcoming ANC elections because a lot of the coal companies are connected to people that are likely to be running coming up soon. And so there's this kind of strange situation where they want to pull this issue into a local ANC race. But in any case, it doesn't seem to have mattered because they have not stopped selling. And in fact, three times more coal is now being sold to Israel from South Africa than before the boycott here. And as a result, someone actually asked a parliamentary question to Minister Barkstow, and he said that... And they said to him, well, are you going to stop selling the coal to Israel? And he said, no. Now, this is an ANC guy. He is an ANC minister of trade. But he's eventually a trade minister and he needs more trade. And he said, look, if you were to cut this off and not consult the WTO, that would be a problem. And also, I can't tell businesses really what to do. So that was a bit of a fail by the boycott lobby, and it'll be interesting to see where that goes. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 Chai FM.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
101.9 Chai FM. And if you are a book person, well, then I've got something for you. Calling all book lovers, the fresh and new Jewish Women's Benevolent Society book sale is happening Sunday, the 31st of May at Genesis Conference Center in Fairmount. Come browse a wonderful assortment of books. We've got everything from newer novels and popular titles to an amazing selection of nonfiction and Judaica. Our stock is freshly sorted with incredible variety, and every book is just 40 Rand. Join us from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. located above the Pick and Pay at Genesis Conference Center. Find your next great read while helping change the lives through the Jewish Women's Benevolent Society's Tertiary Education Initiatives. That's right, the JWBS Tertiary Education Initiative is supported by this particular campaign. So see you there. Go get a book. And it's a great thing to read just as we come up to sort of 2:52. And because we're going to be talking about a book recommendation that you can read if you are interested in various things to do with Israel and Iran. Because, of course, there is a lot going on in that sphere, to put it mildly, just right at the moment. And so I think a lot of people are trying to find something that can give them a little bit of insight into what is going on. Of course, I would recommend that you watch Tehran, which is quite good. I enjoy it on Apple TV, which is about an Israeli spy in Iran. And that's quite fun. But if you want something a little bit deeper, but not too difficult, and actually won't give you all that many facts. It'll just give you some sense about what is going on in the minds of an Iranian revolutionary. Then I would encourage you to read something called The Israeli Republic, An Iranian Revolutionary's Journey to the Jewish State by Jalal El Amahad. And this book was written in the 60s, actually, because Jalal El Amahad was born to a clerical religious family in Tehran in 1923. And he was a teacher all his life, and he was an influential and prolific writer and social critic whose body of work included short stories, novels, travelogues, anthropological studies, essays, reviews, and translations. And his best-known work is Occidentiosis, which was translated into English as West Stuckedness or West Toxification, which is a critique of Westernization in Iran. And this was something that he was very passionate about. He kind of supported the mullahs in and sort of gay. He wasn't part, obviously, in the revolution because he died in 1969. But he was a big part of the mullah regime kind of thinking and this anti-Western sense that this anti-Western sense, which drove a lot of how that part of Iran felt. And so, and as part of this, he actually was courted by the Israeli establishment, of course, who had embassies and whatever in Iran at the time. And he did one of these tours, you know, like you see these people go on tours to Israel all the time, comedians and media people, whatever. So he goes on a tour and he comes back and he wrote a travelogue of an Iranian revolutionary's viewpoint on what he saw in Israel. And it's absolutely fascinating because, of course, by 1979, the mullahs will be in power and it's impossible now to travel to Iran at all. It's a thin book. It's not very difficult to read, but it is written in sort of one of these, is an intellectual, so it's an interesting style. But if you want to understand what an Iranian might have thought about Israel in the 1960s before it all went completely insane, then this is a great place to start, and it also is a great place to end because we come to the end of the show for today. Thank you to everyone who helps put together the show. Vusi on the sound. We've got people on the production. Craig, who pushes all the big red buttons. Dylan Berger, who's always busy with something. And to you, dear listener, join us next week on Chai FM. Playing out today with the Sunstroke Project, which is the Euro entrance to the Eurovision entrance from Moldova. from 19, well, from whatever, 15 years ago. I can't do the math. I'll see you next week.